Actually, very glad that Roy got to read that scripture reading for us this morning, because I'm carrying a little bit of guilt. I know I've stuck him in particular. Just, I never know who's going to read the scripture or anything like that, but I've stuck him with some longer readings. So I'm glad that I get to make up for that. And he gets to read the one verse scripture this time. But Proverbs 18:17, the one who states his case first seems right until the other comes and examines him. This is one of my favorite proverbs, and it's one of my favorite proverbs because it was one of my roommate's favorite proverbs when we were in school together. The proverbs, in the way that they are, there's just so many of them, one after the other, that there's a handful of them that you might have in the back of your mind that you can recall. But unless one particular has some type of impact at a certain moment, they just go one ear out the other until you come back to them. Proverbs 18, verse 17, it has very wide applicability. On the very surface of it, it's a proverb that's very relevant in some type of legal or court proceeding. As a judge, it's not only the first case might seem right at first, but you're a foolish judge if you don't let the second person tell their side. Because people have a tendency of not being completely objective or circumspect about certain circumstances when they have a case to plead. We tend to tell things from our side of the story. And this applies well beyond the range of just a court proceeding. If, as people, we might never have served on jury duty, or we may have never been a judge in any type of case, but we come in contact with people each and every day, whether in the church or in our jobs or in our families. And all of us at some point in time has had somebody come to us and say, hey, I have this gripe with somebody else, or hey, I've been wronged in this type of way, and I either want you to do something about it, or I want your opinion on this matter. And what this proverb is telling us to do is to withhold some of that judgment until we really know the whole circumstances of a story. But the applicability, it even goes beyond that as well. The first case, the one who states his case first seems right until the other comes and examines him. There's even a quality that with the things that we believe or that we've grown up believing, we haven't always had an opportunity to be challenged on those types of things, but we need to be willing to be challenged on things that we believe. We need to be willing to see the other side of certain things of what we believe. That's something that we want others to do with their beliefs that they've grown up with, and it's something that we should be willing to do as well. Now, parents, and especially if you're a parent of multiple kids, you naturally have some of this ingrained in you when you deal with kids, because it is a daily occurrence where some kid yells and screams out that my brother or my sister, she hit me, or she took my thing, or she did this or that to me. And as a parent, the thing that you don't do is just leap into judgment and immediately punish that kid. Because more than likely, there's a little bit more to this story that maybe the first kid that's making the complaint, maybe they had been pounding on their brother this whole time, and they finally got what was coming to them in the end. There's always more to the story, even if the more to the story just means everybody gets punished in the house. I don't think it'd be that funny, but that's the case. Parents have this naturally ingrained into them. But then there's the funny thing. Kids grow up, and then as adults, we just drop the ball. It's not as if, I mean, kids, we recognize that kids are not objective about what they believe. They're the worst at being circumspect or trying to see another side of the story. But adults really aren't that much better. And in fact, as we grow into adults, adults, when we're hearing an adult side of the story, adults just tend to be a little bit more persuasive. Or they learn to be a lot more persuasive than kids are about what really happened in the circumstance. Or adults, what they do is they can tell a much more complex story than a kid can, which makes it hard for you as a listener to understand maybe what are both sides of this story, what really is going on. And what that really requires for us as listeners, and especially if we're applying Proverbs 18, verse 17 into our life, is that we have to be more discerning and more judicious when we're presented with multiple stories. And it's not as if anytime we're faced with a dilemma where one person says one thing and another person says another, I don't think it's the case that one person necessarily has to be lying. In a lot of cases, we just, again, if I'm hurt in some type of way and I'm telling you why I've been hurt and how I've been hurt, we just naturally have a way of emphasizing certain things that other people wouldn't emphasize about a story. And we have a tendency for leaving off certain details that might implicate me in some type of guilt in what's happening. And everybody does this. And as listeners, we have to be judicious about when this happens. And so for us, we're actually going to begin with a story from the Bible. We're going to begin in 2 Samuel chapter 9. But we're going to come to a point where the ultimate threat of this, where we're going with this, is that being able to hear the second case and being able to see both sides of the story, it's going to be important and relevant to how we conduct ourselves within the church, with the relationships that we have within the church. But it's also important for when we come into contact in our relationships outside of the church, and also the things that we believe when we're challenged on what we believe as well. I want to begin in 2 Samuel chapter 9. 2 Samuel chapter 9, we're going to begin. It's going to be a story of David and his relation with two individuals, Ziba and Mephibosheth. And just to set the stage for this, in 2 Samuel, at this point, 1 Samuel is all about the inauguration of Israel's monarchy. And we know that Saul is the first king, and Saul is a terrible king. And it's ultimately David that becomes anointed in place of Saul. But Saul chases David around all throughout the rest of 1 Samuel. But eventually, Saul is killed with a number of his sons, including Jonathan, by the Philistines. It's after that point that David is finally becomes king, but not really, because even after that point, one of Saul's other sons, Ish-bosheth, is pulled up as king by Benjamin and the other tribes, and there's this civil war going on in Israel. Eventually, Ish-bosheth is killed, and David is finally the king over all of Israel. And as king, he realizes that there was always bad blood between Saul and between David. But David always had respect for Saul, and David and Jonathan had deep love for one another. And it's because of this that David, in 2 Samuel chapter 9, which I'm going to read through this chapter, because it establishes the characters that we're working with, it's in this chapter that David says, okay, I want to do something to repay the love I had for Jonathan. In 2 Samuel chapter 9, David said, is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake? Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and they called him to David. And the king said to him, are you Ziba? And he said, I am your servant. And the king said, is there not still someone of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God to him? Ziba said to the king, there is still a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet. The king said to him, where is he? And Ziba said to the king, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lodabar. Then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lodabar. And Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and paid homage. And David said, Mephibosheth. And he answered, behold, I am your servant. And David said to him, do not fear, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan, and I will restore to you all the land of Saul, your father, and you shall eat at my table always. And he paid homage and said, what is your servant that you should show regard for a dead dog such as I? Then the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, all that belonged to Saul and to all his house I have given to your master's grandson. And you and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him and shall bring in the produce, that your master's grandson may have bread to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall always eat at my table. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, according to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so will your servant do. So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. And Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah. And all who lived in Ziba's house became Mephibosheth's servants. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate always at the king's table. Now he was lame in both his feet. So in 2 Samuel chapter 9, there's two important things going on that we should make note of. We're introduced to Mephibosheth, who is Jonathan's son. And we're introduced to Ziba, who is going to be the servant to Mephibosheth. Ziba would have been the servant over Saul's household. And now David's saying, you're going to be the servant over to Mephibosheth, you and your family. And Mephibosheth, if you're a new monarch, you're generally not going to show kindness to the previous monarch's family. And so Mephibosheth is completely taken aback by any of this. And not only because he's part of Saul's family, but also because it mentions twice within this that he's crippled, he's lame. We find out earlier in 2 Samuel chapter 4, verse 4, that the reason that Mephibosheth was lame was because when Saul had died, Mephibosheth was 5 years old, and he was taken by his nurse and fleeing away from the enemy, and Mephibosheth fell. And from that point on, he couldn't walk. Within our day, to be crippled can be hard enough, but within the ancient world, it was also a mark that you're just not completely whole, and you're not going to get the same honor or respect within society. And so for David to not only take into his household and let eat at his table Mephibosheth, who was part of Saul's family, but someone who generally would just not have been regarded as anybody worth caring about, it speaks a lot of David at this time and the love that he had for Jonathan and the love that he's showing. But from here, we're going to see Mephibosheth and Ziba crop up again in 2 Samuel chapter 16. And we're going to see come to play two people that are going to have to state their case to the king. And we're going to see to what extent, who's right, and where's the wisdom in being able to choose, and how difficult it is to choose between two people that have competing cases. But this is exactly what wisdom is supposed to be able to do. Wisdom, we can talk about it in all of these different ways. Wisdom is applied knowledge and everything like that. But wisdom, another way to talk about wisdom is the ability to be able to step back and take in multiple points of views or multiple ideas. And it's the ability to choose the correct path. So in 2 Samuel chapter 16, just to set the stage here, we're only moving up 7 chapters from chapter 9. But there's a lot of stuff that happens between 2 Samuel 9 and 2 Samuel chapter 16. And a lot of it, most of it, is actually pretty bad. Because in 2 Samuel chapter 11, this is the chapter where David commits his sin with Bathsheba. He commits adultery with her and ultimately kills off her husband. And so it's in 2 Samuel chapter 12 that Nathan the prophet comes to David. And David repents, but Nathan puts a curse on David's household and says the sword is never going to depart from your house because of this sin with Bathsheba. And over the next few chapters, 2 Samuel chapter 13 through 15, you see how this starts playing out. And you also see something else as well. David's sin with Bathsheba was his greatest sin, but it wasn't his only sin. David wasn't perfect, and we're never supposed to think of David as perfect. In fact, part of the reason the Bible does this with all of the biblical heroes that are not Jesus, one of the reasons it's doing this is to let us know this is not the Messiah that we're waiting for. David, just like anybody else, is imperfect. And we see how his sin with Bathsheba has these reverberations through what's happening in his life. And it's also an indication that we shouldn't put anybody too high on a pedestal, lest we idolize them, people that are imperfect. So 2 Samuel chapter 13 through 15, after Bathsheba, after he's repented for it, we just see how David's house falls apart and how David just has lapse in judgment after lapse in judgment. Because Amnon, one of David's sons, soon after that, Amnon rapes one of David's daughters, Tamar. And David does nothing. And shortly after that, Absalom, who is also one of David's sons, He says, if my dad's not going to do anything about this, I will. And then he kills Amnon. And David does nothing. And of course, it actually helped Absalom a little bit. It might not have just been about revenge, avenging his sister's rape. But Absalom was going to be next in line to the kingship after Amnon was taken out of the way. Then after that, Absalom conspires against the king in different types of ways, and David never picks up on it. And David does nothing. And it's not until Absalom full out rebels against David that David actually does something, but he flees Jerusalem because he never saw these signs piling up, never recognizes that my inaction is leading to all of this bloodbath that's going on in my family, and he flees Jerusalem on the run for his life. And it's in 2 Samuel chapter 16 where we meet David having fled from Jerusalem. In 2 Samuel chapter 16, when David had passed a little beyond the summit, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him with a couple of donkeys saddled, bearing 200 loaves of bread, 100 bunches of raisins, 100 summer fruits, and the skin of wine. And the king said to Ziba, "Why have you brought these?" Ziba answered, "The donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, the bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine for those who faint in the wilderness to drink." And the king said, "And where is your master's son?" And he's talking about Mephibosheth. "Where is your master's son?" And Ziba said to the king, "Behold, he remains in Jerusalem. For he said, 'Today the house of Israel will give me back the kingdom of my father.'" Then the king said to Ziba, "Behold, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours." And Ziba said, "I pay homage. Let me ever find favor in your sight, my lord the king." So David is on the run, and Ziba comes out to meet David, but Mephibosheth is not with him. And David asks, why is Mephibosheth, this one person that I've showed so much kindness to, why is he not here as well? And Ziba says, "Well, he took your absence as an opportunity that now he's going to get back everything that was taken from him." Even though David had promised him that he was going to get all the lands of Saul, his grandfather as well. And Ziba says, this is just the case. He's rebelling against you as well. And David himself, this is something he's getting used to, that everybody in Israel is just not behind him. Absalom, his son, is not behind him. And person after person has been just, he's found out who his real friends are here. And it seems to him that Mephibosheth is just another one of these people that's not really his friend and has fallen off the map. But the problem is that David, he already makes a judgment here, but so far he's only heard the person that states his case first. And the person that states his case first always seems right until the other comes and examines him. And we'll follow up with this in 2 Samuel 19, verse 24. Between chapter 16 and 19, the rebellion of Absalom is ultimately crushed, and David's bloodthirsty general is the one that takes the honors of killing Absalom, even though David has said, don't kill my son if you can help it. But David is returning to Jerusalem in 2 Samuel chapter 19, verse 24, and he's met by Mephibosheth, who is now going to tell his side of the story. And as we start to read this, we're going to see what Mephibosheth has to say about all of this. But the Bible's, this is one of the fun ways that the Bible operates. It's actually not going to tell us who's right, Ziba or Mephibosheth. It's going to drop some hints about who's right in this, but it's not going to just clear cut say, this is the person who was in the right and this was the person who was in the wrong. Essentially, what it's doing is it's placing us in the same judgment seat as David is forced to be in. It's putting us in the seat of having to listen to the first case, which seems right at first, and then having to hear the other one that comes and examines him. So in 2 Samuel chapter 19, verse 24, "And Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. He had neither taken care of his feet, nor trimmed his beard, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came back in safety. And when he came to Jerusalem to meet the king said to him, 'Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth?' He answered, 'My lord, O king, my servant deceived me. For your servant said to him, I will saddle a donkey for myself that I may ride on it and go with the king. For your servant is lame. He has slandered your servant to my lord the king. But my lord the king is like the angel of God. Do therefore what seems good to you. For all my father's house were but men doomed to death before my lord the king. But you set your servant among those who eat at your table. What further right have I then to cry to the king? And the king said to him, why speak any more of your affairs? I have decided you and Ziba shall divide the land. And Mephibosheth said to the king, oh, let him take it all, since my lord the king has come safely home. So David's faced with a little bit of a quandary because he hears the first case and it seems right to him when Ziba comes to him and tells him what Mephibosheth has done. And granted, Mephibosheth, as we realize, or Ziba, when he told his case to David, Ziba has a little bit of a vested interest in how this story plays out. Ziba has a lot to gain. In fact, initially, David just says, you can have everything that was Mephibosheth's. But it's when Mephibosheth comes to David that at the very least, David realizes, I might have acted a little bit rashly. Because at the end of the day, David is not able to discern, or he just doesn't want to take the time to figure out who's in the right and who's in the wrong. So he just takes what he feels is the middle ground and says, land goes to both of you, and that's it. But seeing the text, there's a number of indications throughout this that Mephibosheth is really the one that's in the right. First of all, Mephibosheth shows why he wasn't able to be there with Ziba in the first place. He said that Ziba betrayed him. And Mephibosheth, he's lame. Once Ziba took that donkey and went off to meet David, Mephibosheth couldn't do anything but stay where he was. But he tells David over and over, he responds in the same way that he did to David back in 2 Samuel chapter 9. He has nothing but love and respect for David. He knows that David's the king, and he's thankful that David in the first place cared for him when basically Mephibosheth's family was just as good as a bunch of dead dogs. That's the language he used in 2 Samuel chapter 9. So this is entirely consistent with Mephibosheth's humble attitude that he had earlier. But there's some other indications that Ziba said that Mephibosheth was pretty much happy, and he thought that he was going to get his territory back now that David's gone. But in verse 24, we see that Mephibosheth had been fasting that entire time, and Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. He had neither taken care of his feet, nor trimmed his beard, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came back to safety. Contrary to what Ziba said, the whole time that David was gone, Mephibosheth, he couldn't stand it. He was in mourning. These are signs of grief and mourning and being sad that David was gone. And it says this happened from the day that David was gone until the day that David arrived. It's an indication. David might not be able to perceive it, but we're dropped this hint to let us know that Mephibosheth, if someone's in the right, it's actually Mephibosheth. And one of the other subtle telling things in here as well, that's actually a little bit of a foreshadowing, is also at the very end, David says, I'm just going to divide this land between the two of you. And it's Mephibosheth, whose land it initially was, who says, look, you can give it all to him, and I'm going to be okay. It should remind us of another incident that's going to happen later in Solomon's life. If you remember Solomon, he's going to be presented with two women that each claim this child is mine. And Solomon, similar to David here, he says, okay, I'm just going to slice the child in half. And ultimately, it's the woman that says she can keep the child. It's that woman that's actually in the right. And so in a funny sense, there's a little bit of foreshadowing that the writer here is wanting us to hit at, that maybe it's Mephibosheth. If he's fine with Ziba just getting the land altogether, then maybe it actually is Mephibosheth who is right in the first place and who's telling the truth. But this is the hard job of being presented with two cases, and we can have some empathy for David. That David is tired, he's angry, he's been anxious, his son has just died, and this rebellion that David never asked for in the first place, even if there might have been ways that he could have taken action earlier on. And so when he's faced with just yet another judgment that he has to make, he's lost a bit of his step. He's lost a bit of a step from the David that we used to know. And on the plus side, we can say that David doesn't make the worst possible decision. in this case. The worst decision that he could have made would to be to favor Ziba over Mephibosheth. But David also misses the opportunity for making the best possible decision, because he doesn't see that Mephibosheth the whole time is the one telling the truth. And at the end of the day, the best he can do is say, I'm going to stick with the middle ground, and both sides, we'll just go with that. It's a warning to us about being too quick to go with the case that's presented to us first, and going with the person who presents their side first, because it always seems right. But at the end of the day, we have to take the second case into consideration. We have to let that second case examine what we thought that we believed in the first place. It's also a warning as well, as with David, to not rush to judgment. This is part of the problem with David. He rushes to judgment and immediately gives things to Ziba. And it's only after the fact that he realized there might be a little bit of difficulty in this. And even after the fact, David does renege a little bit, because he ends up not giving Ziba everything, but gives him half. And so for us as Christians, the one who states his case first seems right until the other comes and examines him. It's relevant in David's case, but it's relevant in our case. First of all, when it comes to the relationships that we have, especially relationships in the church, but this is, we have relationships in the church, out of the church, on the job, all over the place. But this proverb, it's relevant to us when it comes to when we have to listen and when we have to make decisions. Because as Christians, this is just the way that things are. As Christians, and if we have relationships with people, if we have friendships, and if we are in a church where we have people mingling all the time, it's inevitable that people are going to step on each other's feet every once in a while. And as Christians, there are always going to be other occasions in which we might hear something bad said about another Christian. There might be a Christian that we're listening to and needing to listen to, and maybe they're venting about something that happened here or there, and it was involving somebody else. And I'm going to shelve the topic of gossip for another time. Whether I think we recognize that there's a reality that whether it's gossip or not, there are just going to be occasions where we're going to hear ill words spoken of other Christians. And that's just a reality. The lesson for us is that when we hear ill words spoken of somebody else, if they don't have the chance to defend themselves, if we don't have the time to hear the second case, then we can listen, but we need to be able to withhold judgment and not let somebody else's opinion or words color the way that we treat and that we engage with other Christians. Even if other Christians around us have difficulties or problems with somebody else, unless we know the entire case, and unless we've heard that second case, we shouldn't let that affect or color our judgment as well. Because there always is a second side. There always is another side to the story. This is even more important when we're in a position where we have to actually make decisions. And this is where David comes to the fore. And even though he doesn't make the worst possible decision he could have made, it doesn't seem from the text that he makes the best possible decision either. It's not just elders that have to make decisions between Christians, but even individual Christians on a daily basis, whether it's in our family or even within the church, there might be times and places where people within the church are divided on an issue, or people within the church are just divided against each other in certain types of ways. And if we're Christians that are willing to hear and going to hear the second case, we have to be Christians that are willing to be a bridge between people that disagree. And we have to be able to help in that process and not hurt it. And it's also vital that we are willing to hear the second case when it comes to our engagement with people outside of the church. And it's vital that we're willing to hear the second case when it comes to us actually examining our own beliefs. My grandfather, he's been dead now for about 10 years, but he preached for his lifetime. And I don't know that he ever said this to me directly, but he said this to my dad, and my dad over time, he said it to me a few times. It always stuck with him. And he said this, that he had told my dad this, to don't be afraid of the truth. Don't be afraid of the truth and follow it wherever it goes. And he told my dad as well that you follow the truth wherever it goes, even if it means abandoning everything that I taught you. Don't be afraid of the truth. And it's important that we recognize that we shouldn't be afraid of the truth, because I think a lot of times we actually are. We don't think we are, but we're afraid of the truth, or we're afraid that there's a truth out there that could dissuade me from what I've been brought up in, or maybe what I've believed for the last 20 years. We're always afraid of changing our mind, because when we change our mind, or when we have to move, or when we have to shift from what I've believed, or how I believed, or what I have thought was truth in the past, when we have to make shifts, or when we have to consider other types of views on things, it's an indication that I might have been wrong in the past. And it's also an indication that I'm not infallible. I might not always be right when I think I'm right. Growing up in the church as well, we've probably all heard this, and we might have all felt this sentiment before if we were studying with somebody else, or if we've talked with somebody else. And I remember hearing growing up that other people, that Christians might have studied the Bible with somebody else, but at the end of the day, it just came to nothing, because they couldn't pull themselves out of beliefs that they've grown up in, or beliefs that their family had had. But that's something that's not just particular. That's something that's universal. This is the first case that we've heard. If certain beliefs that we have, often they might be the first thing that we've been exposed to, or the first thing that we've come across. And we also, it doesn't mean that that's not right in any type of way, but it does mean that there should always be a willingness to have that challenged. It's only when beliefs that we have are challenged in some way that we find the truth if what we're not believing was the truth. And it's only when our beliefs are challenged that our belief in that truth can actually get stronger, if it withstands the challenges of other things around us. The difficulty for us, sometimes we think that having a certain humility with what I believe, we confuse that with gullibility. But having a humility in what we believe, it doesn't mean that we're gullible. If we recognizing, we don't have to say that I'm wrong in what I believe to recognize that there's the possibility that I make mistakes sometimes. Believing we're mistaken, we don't have to believe that we're mistaken. We just have to believe that it's possible that we can be mistaken, and be humble in how we approach others, and humble in how we engage with others. Because if we find ourselves talking with others, and especially talking with others outside of the faith, and we find our conversations always devolving into an argument every single time, it might not be that we're casting our pearls before swine. It might be that some of the problem is with us, that we're not willing to actually listen or engage people on a very one-to-one basis. At the end of the day, when we sit with others on an equal footing that don't believe things the same way that we believe, and this doesn't have to be, this isn't just between a believer and an atheist, or between someone in the church and someone out of the church. It can also happen between two Christians within the church. We don't always agree on every single thing. But the purpose is not, the purpose shouldn't be to convince the other person why I'm right. But when we sit down with others, the purpose should always be to get to the bottom of what the truth actually is, and what the truth actually is on a certain matter. And hopefully, most of the time, the truth and what we believe is aligning right. We have to be willing and have the wisdom to see when maybe it's me that needs to shift, or maybe it's me that needs to consider other things. As Christians, at the very bottom of what we believe, and the very foundational belief for us, and the foundation on which everything else stands and is built, is the fact that Jesus Christ, God, came to earth, that he lived, that he died, that his death was witnessed, and that he was resurrected from the grave, and over 500 saw him, not just the apostles, but over 500 that he was written about, and that he ascended into heaven to reign, and that he'll come back, and he'll return with judgment. And that's the foundational belief. It's what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, that if Christ was not raised, then our faith is in vain. If you know that you have a need to respond to the gospel, if you know that Christ died and was raised from the dead, that he died for our sin and was raised so that we could live new life as Christians, or if you need to return to the fold, if you need to return back to that kingdom, if you've fallen away, please let that be known, and please come forward as we stand and sing.